Morning, everybody. Jimmy Alcoholic.
Hey.
I know you all spent an hour in prayer this morning and meditation, so proud of you. But let's open up. Let me open up to a prayer for us this morning to start this day. Comes right out of our book. On awakening, we ask you, Father, to help us think about the 24 hours ahead and to consider our plans for the day. We ask you to direct our thinking, especially ask that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonesty, or self-seeking motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask you for an intuitive thought or a decision. We ask that you show us all through the day what our next step is to be, and that you give us whatever we need to take care of our problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will. As we go through the day, when agitated or doubtful, grant us the right thought or action. Constantly remind us that we are no longer running the show. Father, help us humbly say, many times each day, thy will, not mine, be done. So good morning, everyone. It's been a great weekend for me. I thank you so much for having me, and good to see and meet new people and see old people. And Lee and Jason, thank you for your talks last night. It's not easy doing an AA talk. I know we all done it, but, you know, there's this some kind of weird shit that goes on in my head. I know that when I come up here. Like, I got to impress you guys with something. I'm just a drunk, really. You know, I had an opportunity to recover and, you know, and try to pass on what it's been so freely given to me. You know, so, you know, what am I going to talk about this morning? I was asked to talk about golf this morning, right, John?
Yeah.
The most alcoholic sport in the world. I mean, oh, yeah, yeah. We got stories, you know. I came up on Walter Hagen, right? I mean, we talk about that. But think about this. It's 1939. It's April 1939. None of you guys know each other. You're sitting in your little apartment by yourself. You're drunk. Can't stop drinking. And somehow, some way, you got this book called Alcoholics Anonymous brought to your house, whether it was by your wife, a friend, a relative, a doctor, whoever. And you're about to self-diagnose yourself to see if you belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, the fledgling society that we had. Think about that. Just think about that, right? And you turn to page one. Page one in the first edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous was the doctor's opinion. Wasn't supposed to be in there. Bill Wilson wanted Henry Ford to open up the book because he was trying to sell the book. He was trying to, you know, Bill the salesman, he was trying to sell the book, and he thought if Henry Ford, because the cars were just coming out, would write the introduction, more people would come and do that. And Henry Ford said no, because Henry Ford belonged to the temperance movement. He didn't believe in drinkers or drinkers, so he said no. So Bill Wilson goes to a second source. He goes back to Rockefeller, and Rockefeller tells him, I'm not doing it either. So Bill was thinking, who am I going to go to? Who am I going to talk? Who am I going to talk to? So him and Hank Parkhurst, who was a Jersey guy who helped Bill, you know, write the book, basically, said, let's go back to Silkworth. And so as we get the doctor's opinion on page one, after the first edition, that was pushed back into the Roman numerals. There is no literary reason or any kind of historical archives that tell us why that was pushed back into the Roman numerals. Some people say because he was not an alcoholic. Right? Because everything else written from page one on is from an alcoholic. Right? But thank God for Silkworth. Thank God for Silkworth. And yeah, the lineage goes on before that. God was connecting the dots before even Silkworth. But, you know, I live right by Silkworth's grave. Right? He's buried in Glenwood Cemetery in West Long Branch. There's not a time that I'll drive by that cemetery, and it's a real easy see where his headstone is, him and his wife, Dorothea. I'll look in there, and I'll see you guys. I'll see two guys sitting down on a beach chair, whatever, and folding chairs. And I see that blue book in your lap, and it's one drunk talking to another, sharing experience, strength, and hope, our basic service of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so many years ago, I was asked to do a talk on Silkworth in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And, you know, I thought they wanted me to speak on step one. And they said, no, just speak on Silkworth. And I'm like, why? Because I live close to him. I go to his grave. I mean, like, you know, I have some kind of relationship. So, you know, so I called up my buddy, John, who's an archivist in New Jersey. And I said, hey, other than the normal history we know about Silkworth, do you have anything else that maybe could just spark some stuff in my mind? He says, yeah, I do. He goes, I got medical journals that he gave to universities and medical societies. and I'm going to send them to you. Within 10 minutes, I had 27 medical talks that he did to non-alcoholic, to doctors, universities. I'm sure there was a few alcoholics sprinkled in there somewhere, but it wasn't to us. It was to them. But he's talking about us. So Silkworth, you know, our history books tell us that he worked with 51,000 alcoholics, 45,000 at Towns Hospital, and then he went on to Knickerbocker Hospital where he worked with 6,000 more alcoholics. And when I say work with, he didn't just, you know, stamp a piece of paper and said, next. He sat, he counseled, he sat at bedsides, right? And he worked with these men, you know? And what we get from Silkworth is probably one of the greatest things that, you know, doctors can get us on our feet, but they can't keep us sober, right? Now, we need to have some sort of a psychic change. We need to have these, we need something more than a human power to recover from the disease of alcoholism. And so I'm reading these medical journals and something keeps popping out in every one of them, right? He writes a little thing in there, and this is what he says, and he's talking about us to them. He says, for the alcoholic, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, who doesn't fully take the second step, come to believe in a power greater than yourself, and to practice these principles in all your affairs, that guy, that sober alcoholic, still has a reservation and a lurking notion and will drink again. Just let that sink in. So you're sitting by yourself in 1939. How am I going to have this spiritual experience? I don't even know how to do that. You know, what is a spiritual experience? What is a spiritual awakening? What is the psychic change he's talking about? What is the personality change? Interchangeable words. But how do I do this on my own? I mean, look at this. We have each other. You guys do this all day long. You sit at kitchen tables. You read the book to a new guy. Give me instructions or directions on how to have a spiritual experience. You know, Bill's white light experience. Think about this. You know, when Bill had that white light experience, what does he do? He goes back to Silkworth. Our history, our lives were hanging on a thread in that moment. Because Silkworth goes at Bill, you're tripping. I don't know what's wrong with you. Maybe you're DTing or whatever. He goes, I don't know what the hell happened to you. But hold on to what you got is a lot better than what you got, what you ever had. He validated Bill's white light experience. And as a result of that, Bill goes on, and here we are today, 90 years later, and where are we? Delray Beach, Florida. Couldn't even remember where I was there for a second, right? So just the importance of our history, just the importance of what Silkworth does for us, right? And to have this spiritual experience, what I've been talking about, right? So what is a spiritual experience? You know, is this some kind of hocus pocus we're doing here? I think Bill lays it out in the 12 and 12 when he talks about what a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience is. He says, when a man or a woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, to feel, and to believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he's really going somewhere. That life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength, which in one way or another, he had until now denied himself. He finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love, which he had thought himself quite incapable. What he has received is a free gift. And yet, usually, at least in some small part, he has made himself ready to receive it. So here's the question for the weekend. What are you doing with your gift? When you leave here this weekend, what are you doing with your gift? Am I still carrying a message to people that still need to hear this? You know, today we don't have to try to figure it out on our own by just reading this book. Right? Again, that's the map, not the treasure. He just said we need to have a spiritual experience. We need to have a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And as a result of the first 9 steps, we walk into the sunlight of the Spirit, like I said yesterday. But how do I stay out in the sunlight of the Spirit? And, well, we look at 10, 11, and 12. So we have spot check inventories to put the spiritual mirror up to ourselves. Where am I falling short right now, not later on today, when these things crop up, not at 9 o'clock at night, how about 12 o'clock in the afternoon when you're pissed off about something or being selfish about something, right? Bill knows that he's going to deal with a bunch of alcoholics. He wasn't a guru or in any way. He gives us a 6-discipline plan of action for a 24-hour period, how to pray and how to meditate. Why does he do that? Because he knows the baffling feature of the mind. Because I don't know about anyone here, my mind likes to keep me in yesterday with the coulda, woulda, and shouldas. Well, my mind likes to bring me into next week with the fear of everything that's going to happen next week. And the hardest thing that any of us have to do in here is learn how to stay present, right? So he gives us tools, right? And we don't do this 100%. I wish we did, you know, like I said, spiritual progress rather than spiritual faction. But we are given these tools of prayer, meditation, right? And like I just read, on awakening, right? But in the 11th step, it starts when we retire at night, right? When we retire at night. So if I missed anything throughout the day yesterday, I had the opportunity before I went into the rack to look at my day. Where did I fall short? It's the net, right? Ask me 9 questions in that, right? Where was I resentful? Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? And I'll tell you, I was pretty terrible at doing evening review for a long period of time. And then it was a period of time where I got a little bit over the top, writing. And there's nothing wrong with that. A lot of people do that, right? But I'm doing a men's retreat with this guy, Harold Long, back in 2015, I think, or something like that. In the middle of the night, not in the middle of the night, I was going to bed, and my phone goes off, bing, like that. And I open it up, it's a text message from Harold. And he has his whole evening review sent to me. There's like a template. A lot of people know about this template, you know, it asks all the questions, but there's a few other questions that are embedded in that little thing. And so I'm like, you know, next morning I wake up, I said, what's this for? He goes, this is how I do inventory at night when I retire at night. You know, I don't write it out, you know, that's blasphemy in some people's circles, but, you know, it's really just about reviewing my day. You know, when I fall short, the guy that goes to bed angry is going to wake up angry. I need to clear the deck before I go to bed to have a good night's sleep. So I said, okay, I'll start sending the inventory to you. So I copy, paste, and that was on April 16, 2015. I haven't missed a night since that day. I don't say that for a pat on my back. I just know the value of taking a reflective look at my day. I know the value of clearing the deck before I go to bed. I know the value of being honest with myself. I know the value of, you know, this thing called, you know, the sunlight of the spirit way. I got to keep that channel. I got to keep the whole way of darkness clear, right? I sit at my kitchen table all the time and I always point to the glass door like I'm doing now. It's just out of habit. You know, I tell every guy that sits at my kitchen table, there's the goal line right there. It's the sunlight of the spirit. Walk out into the beautiful Jersey Shore sunlight right now. But in order to walk out that light, into that light, you got to walk through the whole way of life and uncover, discover, and discard the darkness that's going on in your life. We got to bring down those walls. I've said that numerous times this weekend. And so now I do that with my guys. I sponsor a lot of guys. And every night, you know, last night before I went to bed, phone beep, 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 beep. And it doesn't take long to read one. And why that's important is because it's accountability, right? Remember that question I asked? Am I being accountable? Yeah. I don't sit there and say, I'm the sponsor, you give me that. No, I'm just as accountable to those guys. Those guys need to see that I'm a human being too, and I make mistakes too, you know? So just a wonderful, valuable thing that I do. I know that, and I know it's for them too, because I know I don't need to call, you know, Tom every day, because I know John read his inventory, and John says, first thing I get up in the morning is I'm calling Tom because he looks like he's having a rough day yesterday. Let's see what's going on. Let's check in on our brothers. I know you guys, the West Side men's group, sorry, I said boys. But after watching some of your behavior, I wasn't too far off, you know? Oh, boy. Oh, boy. I didn't hear nice. So on awakening, right? I got my inventory from last night. On awakening, we consider our plans for the day. Not what I got to do. We all work, kids, whatever. Who am I going to be based on the inventory of yesterday, last night? Yeah, I was a dick yesterday. I'm going to try not to be a dick today. You know, I'm going to try to be honest and considerate and thoughtful. And I'm going to try to look at life through the lens of, or through the eyes of God rather than the lens of my character defects. And that's a tall order sometimes for us, right? And so, you know, we go through the day, you know, You know, one of the greatest words that's written in that book is pause. When agitated or doubtful, when I'm going through my day, pause, push away from life. I don't need to have the answer. The old idea, remember, we're driven by old ideas. Here's an old idea. I'll figure it out. No, you can't. How about just pause and move away and let God work? Let God work. And how many times have you done that? I'm sure you a lot of you guys have that in your own experience where I just didn't get involved and it all worked out without my help, right? Countless times, you know? So, and then, you know, they talk about, and another discipline he talks about is, you know, having this period of meditation. In my house, because my wife's in recovery, she's sober 29 years, you know, I have my little spot downstairs, you know, I put on the coffee pot, I go, I got my books, you know, I have the prayer book, I got a, you know, it all depends. It's not the same every day, but I got books that I read, and, you know, I was always encouraged to read all this literature, you know, and I said it to Jared, I think I was talking to him. I said, you know, it's amazing how many books you can read 2 pages at a time. So I'll read 2 pages of, say, you know, spiritual imperfection, right? I can't consume a whole book of knowledge, right? Let me read 2 pages and just sit with it. What's the author trying to say to me, right? Next day, 2 pages. Next day, 2 pages. I've done that with, you know, conference-approved books like, you know, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, AA Comes of Age, all that great stuff. But there's so many great books that we should be taking advantage of that are not even in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I just read the book of Father Ed Dowling, who was the Jesuit priest that, you know, met Bill at the 24th Street Clubhouse in New York City and became Bill's spiritual advisor. That was a fascinating story. Not the sole sponsorship. This was his autobiography. And man, he was just like us, but he wasn't an alcoholic. He had all the same problems we all had to do, but he wasn't an alcoholic, you know? And, it was just really amazing when he met Bill and, you know, he kind of associated the 12 steps with the, what is that called? The St. Ignatius exercises. I think that's how you say that. My Catholicism's failing me at this moment. Yeah, the exercises of St. Ignatius, right? I think that's it. I'll just make that up anyway. You guys won't know. We make up a lot of stuff up here, believe me. Point being, you know, am I taking advantage of this stuff? Why? Because this is the stuff that keeps me in the light. This is the stuff that keeps that channel clear, you know, that opens my mind, you know, opens my mind to a spiritual way of living. And if I do that, man, I have a better chance of having a better day. But, you know, so I do my prayer and meditation, and my wife is upstairs in my office or her, our office and, or a bedroom, and she's doing her prayer. I mean, her prayer and readings, right? And then every morning we come down and we have in our family room, you know, we sit and we meditate together. It's one of the greatest things I've ever done with my wife. You know, I mean, if you have a phone, there's a million gazillion apps about meditation. And I particularly like, you know, guided meditations. It just keeps me in the flow of things, right? And I think I listened to Insight Timer. That's one of the big ones. And, you know, I popped one of them on. I popped one on one of them on this morning before I came out here. I need to be connected before I stand up here, that's for sure. And I, you know, and I'll do something with my wife, and then we'll talk about, you know, our day, and then on with the day. Okay, let's go live life to the fullest today, you know, with all the challenges that are going to happen, you know. So, again, the value of, you know, 10-step, 11-step of introspection, of looking, you know. I can tell you one thing, and I've learned from experience, that you can't grow spiritually and beat yourself up at the same time. Self-loathing, self-condemnation. That's why in the 11th step it talks about an appropriate feeling for oneself. You know, I deserve this life. I deserve sobriety. I deserve the gifts that God wants to give me, right? I just got to be an open channel to that stuff. So I need to remove all the things. And I wish I could, like, again, I can't emphasize this even more. I wish I could tell you I do this perfectly, but I don't, right? But it's in the trying. It's in the trying. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we try. I love that word, try. You know, we don't do this 100%, right? I don't know. Think about how many guys you sponsored through the years. I like to tell you, 100%. You know, that would be a fallacy. I don't even know what that number is, but I try. Why? Because I know in helping you, I'm helping myself. I mean, one of the greatest things that happened to Bill Wilson, right? In those first 6 months, he couldn't get anyone sober. Why? He was trying to jam spiritual, that white light experience on people's throats, right? And then he went back to Silkworth. Silkworth said, Bill, you got the cart before the horse. You got to hit him with the medical, you know. You have to hit him with the, what you suffer from medically. You know, this phenomenon called craving, the obsession of the mind. And when they're able to identify with that, that's when you come in with, you know, the spiritual aspect. And if you read the chapter, Working with Others, you know, that's not about sponsorship. Though sponsorship could happen out of that. It's about how to have a conversation, how to meet the drunk at the kitchen table, how to meet a drunk at the front door, right? Qualifying the drunk, right? And we don't talk about spiritual principles right off the bat and you got to do this, you got to do that. No, sit down and talk about your drinking, right? Our basic service. It's the greatest thing we have in here, right? Identification, one drunk talking to another, right? So, you know, I think it was 2005 and... Well, let me go back. Let me backtrack a little bit. So I get in this group when I'm, you know, when I, on day one, you know, and right out of the gate, man, these guys were teaching me about AA etiquette. Now, I know the West Side Men's Group do that. AA etiquette. Nice. I don't really believe that. I just like to hear nice, you know. But, you know. We have a pamphlet called the AA Group, Where It All Begins. It's probably one of the greatest group pamphlets we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a lot of pamphlets for everything, but that's one of the greatest ones. You know, group life. How do you live in a group? How do you fight to be part of a group, right? It's vital to understand some of that stuff, right? I mean, that pamphlet is so important that, you know, I'm a past delegate. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about that. But there was a time when that came to the General Service Conference three times to take that pamphlet and put it in this book as an appendix, right? And it got shot down three times, right? But it's so valuable. So when I sit with a guy, I give him that pamphlet. And I give him this, and, you know, obviously a big book, you know. But in I don't even know where I was going with that. I just drew a blank.
Nice.
Well, when I come down, when I moved down here to Plantation, Florida, and I joined that famous world group, the West Side Men's Boys Club or whatever, I won't have any mental blank spots. Oh, I know where I was going. So, 2005, you know, me and my wife said, hey, you know what? We should start a group in our neighborhood. We both belong to different home groups. And I said, okay, let's gather a couple of people that we like from other groups, you know, let's create a steering committee. And let's, like Bill Wilson ironing out on the anvil of experience when he wrote the traditions, let's come up with a format that we want to do. And so my group today, it's a big book study, all right? It's a 28-week cycle. After the 28 weeks, we go through 3 weeks of the traditions, then we do the 28 weeks again, and then we do 3 weeks of the concepts. And then it's just like that. And we invite people in to speak. So John would come in and talk about the doctor's opinion. You know, Tom would come in and speak on Bill's story. You know, when we get to the inventory, we've got a huge-ass whiteboard. And for 3 weeks... You know, you would come in and, you know, you would read resentment on week one, and on the whiteboard, you would do an inventory to show people how easy writing inventory really is, especially to the new person. Second week, you would do your fears. You know, you put an example on the board and just walk through it as you're reading the literature. And then on the third week, you know, you would talk about, you know, any harms that you cause sexually or problem or harms other than sexual. You know, it's, people think we just write a sex inventory, but the truth of the matter is he talks about our conduct. So yeah, we look at our financial harms, our emotional harms, maybe for some of us, our physical harms, you know, that kind of stuff, right? So we format this whole thing and we go to prayer. And we prayed that 30 people would show up the first night. And on, January 22nd, 2006, we opened up the doors and 175 people walk in on day one. And we had a lot of tables and we said, we're going to ditch the tables. We need more chairs. And, you know, like I said the other day, last night, you know, our group averages anywhere between 250 and 300 every Sunday night for a book study. It's a real pocket of enthusiasm, you know. And yeah, people piss me off and, you know, but so we were a meeting. Year one, we were a meeting. Year two, we became a group. Hope you know the difference. That's why you have a pamphlet, AA group. It right? Tells you the difference between a meeting and a group. So they needed a GSR. And they asked me, "They, who wants to be in the GSR? And in my head, I'm 19 years sober. I don't do that shit. I'm not doing that stuff. That's how I felt, right? I'm a great home group member. I'll make coffee. I'll set up chairs. I'll do all that stuff. But to do stuff outside the group, no way. And God started to do for me that day what I couldn't do for myself. Because all of a sudden, my hand starts to go up. And you ever have this conversation? What the hell are you doing? What the hell are you doing? What the hell are you doing? That's what happened to me. And little do I know that God's going to put me on a path that I never even knew existed. And I become the GSR for this group. And I go to a thing in Hunt Valley, Maryland. It's called NARASA, Northeast Regional AA Service Assembly. All the service geeks and, you know, lunatics. And I go down there, 19 years sober. I got to tell you, I felt like a newcomer walking into a meeting. I was terrified because I don't know what the hell I'm doing, right? And I see these two old guys that are in there, and, you know, and they were from my neighborhood. I'm like, well, I wonder what they're doing here. Little do I know. And when I got to talk to them, I just saw them at meetings. They never talked about their service resume. One was a past trustee at large. The other one was a past regional trustee. You know, he's a truck driver and a bartender, and he's a regional trustee for the Northeast. I'm like, I didn't know that. And so this one guy, John Q, tall guy, he past delegate, past trustee at large, United States, takes me under his wing, and he hands me a service manual. He goes, I just want you to read one thing, you know, the service manual, that other book that could put you to sleep at night. And he goes, just read this little excerpt. And if you go into an old manual and you go to S20, you'll see why do we have a general service company? Why do we do the things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous? And it's written by a guy by the name of Bernard Smith. Bernard Smith is a non-alcoholic Class A trustee who was Bill Wilson's personal lawyer and helped Bill put out what we have today, Alcoholics Anonymous, the structure of AA. And in this thing, he goes, why we do the things we do is not to ensure our sobriety. We're here. You guys know what to do when that little knucklehead shows up at the door. You know how to pull him into the herd. You know how to sit him down at a table and read this book to him and watch him, his life become unbelievable. You guys know that. The girls know that. But why we do the things we do in AA is not for us. So the guy right now in Delray Beach, Florida, on Atlantic Avenue, who's cracking open that bottle of whiskey right now, not knowing that there's 50 guys in this room that have an answer to his problem. Right now, there's a woman somewhere in Delray or South Florida that's a single mom that can't wait to put those three kids down for a nap and crack open a bottle of wine, just wash your day away. Right now, in this moment, at whatever your local hospital is, all the way up to my house in New Jersey and every hospital in between, there's a baby being born destined for alcoholism. And I started to understand the responsibility I have as an individual member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that saved my life. And what that responsibility is to make sure that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous are never closed. So I need to participate. I need to get involved. I need to be a member of the fellowship that saved my life. I can't be a guy that's on the fringes or on the sidelines. I got to be in the herd. And so what happened to me is I started to understand the truth about alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to see the big picture rather than my little home group. And as important as my home group is, and it is the most important place in the world for me, it's a sacred place. I have a responsibility to carry the message to the alkie that's out there that doesn't know we're in here. For those who know Tom Iverster, he was a guy, an alcoholic. He died with 66 years of sobriety. Tom was a guy that killed two people in a car accident down in Southern Pines, California, North Carolina. And when Tom got out of prison, he started to do prison work, and he eventually became the warden of the prison that he was incarcerated at. You're not allowed to do that in the United States anymore. And Tom was a big prison guy, like, you know, big service guy. But he said something once that really rung my bell. He said, you should always be bringing a meeting into a place where you never want to wind up again. So whether that's bringing a meeting to a treatment center, whether it's going to a detox, whether it's bringing a meeting behind the walls, you should be carrying a message to the person who doesn't know out there in those places about us in here. And I took that to heart, and I know the importance for me. You know, I go to treatment centers, detoxes. I haven't been into jails in a while, but, you know, I just know I've been in enough jails. I've been in meetings in prisons where the people in prison behind the walls are freer than a lot of people that I know that are sitting, not in this room, close. This is the West Side Men's room. Nice. But
That's our part.
Yeah.
I dropped the gun. When that flight attendant walks down the aisle, would you like a soda or something?
Nice.
So that's the point. That's the point. You know, am I involved? Am I carrying the message, right? And so, you know, so I started to work down that inverted triangle. If you're familiar with that, who's in charge of AA? It's you, the groups. That's who's in charge. No trustees or delegates. That's, you know, you're at the bottom of the pile, right? And so I started to work down that thing. I became a DCM. I started to do became something else. I became the area chairperson, hardest job ever in AA. It's like taming, it's like, you know, herding cats, as you would hear. I remember I called up my sponsor, Bob. I said, you know, I got elected as the area chair, which I run the business of the area. And he goes, I got one suggestion for you. I said, what's that? He goes, make sure you bring your recovery to your service work. I said, well, that's a nice old timer throw out line. Until I ran my first assembly and all the people coming to the microphone, I said, now I know what he's talking about. I'm going to kill this mother. Yeah. And then, you know, I got elected as the alternate delegate. And then I had the privilege and honor of being elected as the delegate to the General Service Conference in 2021. And, you know, the first year was a virtual thing, which was really tough. Sat on a computer. I was just, you know, we were just starting to do Zoom meetings. I mean, you know, 10 hours a day looking at a Zoom, like looking at that box. You know, at the end of the day, I would like sit in bed. I thought I was on a boat in the middle of the ocean, like I was experiencing vertigo just from staring at that little thing all day long. And it was a great experience. But year two, we did it in person. We went back to Brooklyn. And I'm driving up to Brooklyn. I'm the closest living delegate. Well, I'm the closest delegate at that time. Everyone had to fly in. I live 60 miles south of New York City. And so I'm going to drive in. And as I'm driving up, I said, let me drive through the city I grew up in, Jersey City, which is, you know, on one side of the Holland Tunnel, New York's on the other side of the Holland Tunnel. And so I drove into where I was raised and born. And isn't it amazing when you get old, you go back to where you grew up and how small it is? Like, I thought the streets were like seven lanes wide. It was like, how did I even learn how to, I don't even know how to parallel park no more. I mean, you know, it's, and I drove past that house, that two family house, 74 Warner Avenue. And I looked at that house and I said, a lot of violence went on in that house. Two family house, that's how we lived. Two families, seven of us on the first floor, my aunts and uncles and my cousins on the second floor. One phone, one bathroom. How the hell did we do that, right? Different times. And, I escaped that. I drove to Wally's, the first bar I ever drank in. 15 years old, I got served in a bar because I was tall enough and my chin hit the top of the bar. Old man bar. He didn't care. What do you want, kid? I don't even know how to order a beer. You know, I mean, it was weird, but... And how many years I spent in Wally's. And then I drove around the streets that I would walk aimlessly for close to 2 years, homeless on those streets. And jumping on the PATH trains and jumping the turnstiles and going into the city and just selling my soul for another drink. Taking everything of value like a family, pushing it across the bar. Taking everything of an education across the bar for a drink. Taking everything of value across the bar for a drink. A marriage across the bar. Jobs across the bar. And here I am, driving around, and I couldn't stop crying. The gratitude I have for Alcoholics Anonymous and the life I've been given. And all you're asking me to do in return is to pass it on. Just to pass it on. Meet a drunk where he's at. Not where I'm at. Not with 38 plus years of sobriety. Meet the drunk where he's at. Get down into the hole with him and show him how you got out of the hole. Step 12, we try to get in the hole and we try to get the guy out of the hole. And all we do is pray for the guy if he can't get out, right? We don't have a magic wand and we don't twist arms in here, right? We try to help the person who still suffers. And sometimes we do good and sometimes we don't. The gratitude I have for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, come to Florida? Hell yeah. What day? What time? Right? If I could do it, I'll go anywhere, really. You know, I'm fortunate to be retired. I'm fortunate to be able to go to places like this. I'm fortunate to be invited. First time I spoke, I think I told a bunch of these guys, and I'll kind of end with this, you know. First time I spoke, it was in Naples, Florida at a conference. And a guy calls me up and says, hey, we want you to speak. So I thought he was pulling my leg right off the bat. He goes, no, somehow Mike, a talk I did got on a CD, and he heard the CD, and then he says to me, I said, okay, I'll come. When? He told me, he goes, oh, by the way, you're replacing someone. I said, oh, really? Who's that? And I don't even know what he's talking about, replace. He goes, you're replacing Sandy Beach. That's what I did. That's exactly what now I know you're pulling my leg. He goes, no, really, you know? And he goes, I said, okay, I'll come. And he goes, oh, yeah, by the way, it's Halloween night, and you're going to be speaking with two guys that celebrate on Halloween night. And immediately I knew the other guy was Clancy, because I knew Halloween night was his anniversary. And the other guy was a guy by the name of Bob Darrell, who some of you guys heard from Vegas. So my first time out of the gate doing a conference was me replacing Sandy with Clancy and with Bob Darrell. And to say that I soiled my pants would be an understatement. I was never more nervous. So, you know, Lee, you said you were nervous. I mean, here's another thing Tom Iverson used to say. If you're not nervous before an AA talk, you better stop talking because your ego's in the way now. Right? We all have that in here, right? I have that up here all weekend, right? But I'll never forget. It was Halloween night, and I'm looking down, and there was a guy dressed like the Joker from Batman, but like a professional look, not a plastic look, you know? And I just stared at that guy and said to myself, if this guy can get dressed like that, I can pump out a 50-minute talk in no time. And I don't think my chin moved 1 inch either way. And I just stared at him, and I was like talking to the Joker on my first talk. I mean, it was, you know, and the rest is history. And here I am, you know, here I am in Delray Beach, Florida, doing what I love to do, is carrying a message to the alcoholic still suffers. And this isn't, the real work is at my kitchen table. The real work is on committee work. The real work is carrying a message. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, I had to get involved in a lot more than just sponsorship, right? Sponsorship is vital. It's important to sit with another drunk, but we carry the message in a lot of different ways. And for you guys that go into treatment centers and prisons and all those places, we carry the message through our literature. You know, we're handing out big books left and right. We have libraries with big books. I mean, you know, I do what I can. We all do what we can, you know? But the idea is we have to do something, right? This is not a free ride. I mean, God, if I had a good memory, if I could remember every person that came to AA, and somebody said it here in the group or somewhere, you know, don't let the life that AA gave you take you away from your AA life. We get a lot of cash and prizes in here when we stay sober. We go on beautiful golf trips. We get beautiful homes. We get beautiful women. We get children, grandchildren, we get all the gifts that God intended us to have. Don't squander it with my selfishness and self-centeredness. And as a result of that, I live a blessed life. I said yesterday, there's a lot of promises in this book. And a lot of them are like in the realm of like just an internal feeling, right? Like, I'll know peace and serenity, you know, I'll feel useful again and all. But some of my favorite promises are on page 15. And I'm going to end on this. So Bill has that white light experience. And this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill has that white light experience. And what he thinks for in the hospital bed, how can I carry this message to people who need this? Anyone else think like that? I'm like, I got mine. I'll see you later. I mean, it's just a miracle how God moved this guy's mind. And then he goes on to say, you know, he's sitting with Ebby, and Ebby says, faithful that works is dead. You got to carry this message. You got to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness of what God has given you, and more importantly, taking it out into the world and carrying this message. And Bill even states in here, even though I was, you know, I still filled with self-pity, you know, all the crap, resentment and all, I knew the importance of one drunk talking to another, right? And I love this line in here, you know, it says, I was fortunate that they didn't bring me back into the company to work. Most of us be pissing and moaning that we didn't get work immediately. Bill didn't see that way. You know why? He was awake to the truth. And the truth was, he was fortunate because it gave him the opportunity to travel around and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. But listen to these promises, because this is what you guys see down here in the West Side Men's Group on every Thursday night. This is what I see in my group every Thursday night, Sunday night. This is what we see in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when we take a front row to this show. And this is what we see. We commence to make many friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us. Promise. I lost my spot. What's going on among us? I'm sorry. Of which we, a wonderful thing to feel part of. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure. Promise. I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in a path that really goes somewhere. Promise. I have seen the most impossible domestic situations right it. Promise. I have seen feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. Promise. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Promise. I have seen businessmen and professional men regain their standing. Promise. There is scarcely any form of trouble, any misery, which has not been overcome among us. Promise. You don't see that if you don't come. You don't see that if you say to yourself, you know what? Sunday night football is more important than being at my home group. So home group life, this way of life, Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship I crave. Thank God I'm here. Thanks a lot for the time.